This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind here on WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial, Tuesdays and Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Bringing you ideas, concepts, and guests to help you lead a more powerfully minded life. Today, we're going to talk about rejection. Rejection, a big word. According to the dictionary, a word that means the refusal to accept or to discard as worthless. Rejection. Do you ever feel discarded? Do you ever feel worthless because somebody pushes you away? How do you deal with rejection in your life? Well, if you're in the arts, you have to learn to live with it because dealing with rejection is a part of the art. If you're part of a creative process that you know will be liked by some and not appreciated by others, if you don't get that fact and if instead you get angry at anybody who does not appreciate your work, you can't last as an artist for sure. Does that mean that if you're an artist, rejection doesn't hurt? Well, we're here to find out about that today. Because the word rejection has gotten to be too important in our lives. Don't you think rejection is a bad thing? Did you ever hear the word rejection used in a positive sentence? I'm sure it can be, but rejection, you know, your body rejects the infection. You rejected the virus. No, usually rejection conjures up images of disappointment, shame, feelings of worthlessness, depression, and organ rejection. Do you have a fear of being rejected? Or are you one of those controlling people who never deals with the issues because you never take the kind of risk where you might get rejected? That's a fairly decent strategy, you know what I mean? Are you one of those people who would never try to get to know anyone unless they showed an interest in you first? Never smile unless smiled at first? If you're one of those, you are unconsciously afraid of rejection, like most people. You just never deal with it. You never risk it. That's why so many people never leave their jobs. Rejection. Well, you better get a grasp on this one, because at some point in your life, if you're overly sensitive to rejection, you're going to have a tough time. It happens more and more as you get on in age. You can feel rejected because people don't find you attractive any longer. You know, if you're one of those people who spent their lives getting by on being cute or attractive or sexy, either consciously or unconsciously, then you begin to panic when people are not turning their heads as you pass by. Or you can feel rejected because your husband or wife wants a divorce, especially if you've no developed sense to fall back on. Or you can even feel rejected because your children want to grow up and leave home. Or you can feel rejected because your mate becomes sexually dead around you. There are so many life experiences, more and more as you get older, that will present you with the opportunity to deal with your fear and reaction to rejection. So that's what we're doing here today. We're talking about rejection. How do you deal with rejection? When's the last time you felt rejected? Well, stay tuned today, because I'm going to teach you something about this subject that'll help you out, so that you won't feel so vulnerable to this simple phenomenon of existence, rejection. First of all, let's start with feelings. Let's talk about feelings, and I especially address this to all you psychotherapists out there who've been filling your clients' brains with misinformation about human emotions. Let me start by saying there is no such feeling as feeling rejected. Shall I repeat? There is no such emotion as feeling rejected. Am I getting your attention? How could that be? Here I am doing a program about being rejected. Think of all the hours you've spent with your therapist trying to sort out your emotions, having those pregnant times when your therapist asked you how you reacted to something, when they were saying something to you, and the way the therapists tend to talk, like they have the answer but you don't, but they want you to arrive at their conclusions by yourself because it's good for you. And then you tell them about how you asked your boss for a raise and were turned down, and so the therapist says to you, "So how did that make you feel?" As if the word feel has five E's in it. And you start searching for the right answer to get the therapist's approval. You say, I was disappointed. And the therapist says, so what did you feel? Oh, I was angry. But what feeling was other than that anger? Well, I guess I felt rejected. That's right, rejected. You felt rejected. It's hogwash, my friend. Rejected is not a feeling. It's a perception of someone's behavior. Rejection is not a feeling. In fact, if you'd like to use one good rule of thumb in trying to learn about your emotions, just remember this. With the exception of only one that I know of, there are no emotions that end in the last two letters ED. If there's an ED ending at the end of a word, it does not describe an emotion. It describes your perception of what somebody else did to you. The only exception to this rule is dejected. That's a feeling, dejected. It's the only one with an ending word that I believe accurately describes a feeling, but with that exception noted, there are no emotions with ED endings. I felt disappointed means somebody or something disappointed you. It's a statement of perception. Now, what happened when you got disappointed? After they disappointed you, then you had a feeling like you might have gotten angry. Maybe you got angry, or maybe you got sad, or maybe you felt powerless. But there's no such thing as feeling disappointed. You can be disappointed, but you don't feel disappointed. Sad is usually the emotion that goes with disappointment, because sad means you lost something. The same is true of rejection. It's not a feeling. It's a perception. And even then, it's not real, even as a perception. We've got to take a closer look at that. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. We're talking about one of the most misunderstood human experiences today, rejection. Let's take a little closer look. Let's try logic for a moment. If someone tells you that they have no use for you in their lives, like if you go for a job interview and you don't get hired, or worse than that, you have a job and you get laid off, downsized, is that rejection? Or if you're a single person and you go out on a date, and your date doesn't want to do it again, is that rejection? How about this? Your son decides that he doesn't want to talk to you anymore. It happens. Is that rejection? Your son wants to leave home and get his own apartment. Is that rejection? Whatever happened to respecting someone else's free will? Rejection. Remember the definition. Discarding as something useless. Is that what you feel? No. If you dig a little deeper, you're going to have to ask the question, what are you really feeling when you perceive that someone is rejecting you? And by asking that question, you start to get a handle on what's going on. When someone doesn't respond positively to you, it forces you to face yourself. Maybe you were putting too much hope in someone or something, and by their not responding favorably, you're forced to look at yourself a little more realistically. Maybe you were just saying, this is my dream, here it is, and it's just about to happen. So you go out on a date and you say, this date is going to be perfect for me. And the date says, well, not you. But you had too much in there, you see. The feeling of rejection very often comes as a result of, or this perception of rejection, as a result of hopes. So what do you focus on? The opportunity to examine your life a little closer? Of course not. You focus on the rejection. You focus on the person rejecting you. Let's say you're feeling lonely and depressed, and you meet a new person, sidle up to them, have a date. Your spirit lifts for a little while. You escape for a short time. Your growing personal feeling of despair. You focus your attention on the most exciting thing in your life, the new date. And then he doesn't call back. If you get depressed and someone asks you what you felt, you say rejected, but it's a lie. You feel like you did before you overinvested in this new person, or this new car, or this new boat, or this new house. I know people who feel rejected when someone outbids them on a house. It's a house. So in many ways, the feeling of rejection itself is a fraud, a camouflage, for another awareness about yourself that you would rather not see. The people who have the most trouble with rejection are the people who have the most trouble being with themselves, alone in a peaceful kind of way. If you're not friendly with yourself, if you can't be with yourself, then you're always looking for somebody else to be accepting of you. People who fear or overly react to rejection are usually narcissistic people who tend to overinvest in single events. People who have their self-worth attached to a positive feedback from other people. Now let's describe what narcissism really is. Narcissism is not self-love as many people think it is. Narcissism is the attachment to an image of yourself, something of yourself that you think is lovable. So when you're a kid, you look around and you say, how am I going to get love? And you decide that the way to get loved is to be a certain way. I'll be nice. I'll be kind. I'll take care of mommy. I'll be good. I'll be bad. I'll be just an irritant. I'll be whatever I am. But this way, somebody's going to love me. So you create a character, and that character is your narcissistic image. People who are overly react to rejection are usually people with a narcissistic image who tend to get busted by the fact that whatever their strategy was, it didn't work. Nobody loved you for what you did. So if you have a strong narcissistic sense and you get on stage and you don't get applauded and nobody likes your act, or you go for an interview and nobody accepts you, it's a blow to your, what they call your ego, or your perception of yourself. People who are not in touch with their real selves, who strive to be an image of themselves rather than find their real selves. People who overreact to rejection are usually folks who choose fantasy over reality, who invent truth rather than live truth. So why do we make so much of it? Why are some people so oversensitive to rejection in any form? Well, we must say that a person's childhood certainly is going to lay a groundwork for your reaction to rejection. And it's a funny thing. If your parents treated you like you were not important, a nuisance or an irritation, then that becomes part of what is loving to you. Loving is being treated like a nuisance or an irritation or as being not important. If that's what love is, then you would only find people who treat you that way. And in some way, even though it feels bad, it kind of turns the corner into feeling like love. Sounds odd, doesn't it? If you're in an abusive relationship, I promise you, you had an abusive parent. A person who experiences their parents, either one or both, as rejecting them, goes on to search out relationships with people who will do the same, push them away, treat them badly, because that's what love is to them. On the other hand, people who are overloved by a parent tend to be the people who set up the kind of intimacy barriers with people that makes everybody who tries to love them feel like they are being rejected, not acceptable as they are. So if you're overloved, if you have a parent who overloves you, who gets too close to you, you tend to become the rejecter, pushing them away as if you were trying to keep your mother away from swallowing you up. And the drama goes on and endlessly until someone wakes up and says, what am I getting so bent out of shape about? You know, I just tried to buy a ticket. There were no tickets left. Why did the policeman give me a ticket? Why do I consider that a rejection? That becomes the big question, not focusing on what the other person did to you, but focusing on what your overreaction is telling you about yourself. And we tend to repeat our past and perpetuate it. We prefer to blame others for our misfortune. This is Armand DeMille with you with A Positive Mind. You're going to have a lot of stories about this, and I would like to hear from you. Since we're working with WBAI in a different format for now, the only way that you can communicate with me currently is through email. So if you go to positivemind.com or if you go to armand@thepositivemind.com, I would like to get emails from you related to the subjects that we're doing. Today we're doing rejection. I would like to hear from you, and I would like to hear if it's okay with you to read part of whatever you send me on the air. It's up to you. If you want to tell me something, I would like to read it. If you would like me to read something or you'd like me to answer something, I will try my best to do it. I may not be able to respond to all of the emails. Mostly, I cannot do it by sending you letters back. But there is stuff that you have to say about it. I learn a lot from you on Facebook. I learn a lot from people who take a subject and they'll dialogue it in Facebook. But if you'd like to send me an email, it's armand@thepositivemind.com. And we'll take that and we'll work that into our future shows. If there's a subject that you would like us to cover, we'll pick that up as well. So let's go back to this rejection. Nobody can reject you. Nobody can discard you as worthless, because you're not. If somebody doesn't do what you want them to do, or if somebody doesn't embrace you, it may have nothing to do with you. What if there are interviews for a job, but the boss is intent on hiring his cousin? But the real thing he has to do is he has to get people in for interviews. But you really want the job and you don't get it. If only we could hear the truth. If only we could learn from the countless rejections we have to face every day. Like, I recently put out a call for an artist who wanted to work with me at creating a wall art for a new psychotherapy center that I was helping build. Got a lot of responses, many from fine artists who had tremendous talents. But I had to turn a lot away. Another time I was looking for people who would make a t-shirt, The Positive Mind. I was looking for logos. I thought that's a definite thing that has to be done, you know, so that you could wear it at the beach and then people would pass by and they would see you and say, hey, you know that. Well, people sent me some versions of it that were surprising. So I had to tell about 30 people, no thank you, but thank you. Almost everybody graciously accepted my refusal, but there were a few who were absolutely obnoxious about me choosing someone else. They were angry, as if I was personally rejecting them, not the style of their work. I understand. And I wondered, how is it that so few asked me what I thought about their work? How many didn't ask for feedback? You won't get honest feedback from people who reject you. Most people are reluctant to tell the truth. So if you have to get feedback from somewhere, you know, you might try getting it from people. Some good friends might be giving you positive feedback or may give you real feedback one way or another. Or are you one of those people who get angry at people who tell you the truth? There are some people who are so frightening that if they were to ask you, do you like my hair this way? You would say, yes, absolutely, it's wonderful. Do you want to be one of those people who have people telling you just what you want to hear for the moment? Recently, there's been some examination of child-rearing practices. It used to be that if you were a loving parent, when your child came home with anything, you would say to the child, oh, it's wonderful, what a wonderful artist you are. Look at that fabulous thing, that fantastic thing that you have, that you just built, it's beautiful, the painting is, you're a fabulous artist, and they would do things like that. But they found that this behavior results in children not being able to determine what they are doing that is of value and what is not of value. A good example of this is if you look at any of the Star Search programs on TV, where you see somebody get up on stage and present something that's absolutely horrendous. And you wonder, how did they do that? And then you picture them, you know, usually in the Enneagram, those of you who know the Enneagram, usually it's a 5. That's a specialist who stays in their basement and practices. How did they do this? How did they develop an art so bad? That's because while they were in the basement doing this, their mothers would come down and say, oh, how wonderful it is, how fabulous it is, how great it is. And then go back upstairs, and then you'd be down there practicing singing again, and you'd sing lousy. You could sing terrible. You could be off key. So they would be constantly reinforcing stuff. And the mother may not even hear what the boy is doing. They may not even hear anything. They just love their child and everything is glorified. Now you take that child who thinks that they're just the cat's meow, and they walk upstairs and they go into the world and they're shocked, stunned by the response that they get. Now, TV shows used to like to exploit this kind of innocence in people so that people would laugh at that person and wonder, how could that person even think that they could sing? They don't do it anymore because they've gotten some bad feedback about it. But this is what happens with a child. So celebrating a child And giving them too much positive reinforcement sometimes works against the child. We need evaluations. We need to be told what we are doing is good or not good by your perception. And so you could be saying, I like what you did. I like this piece of work, but try not to over-exaggerate it. Because what happens later is you become sensitive to the way that you get turned down. Now, on the other side, when you are deciding to tell somebody you don't like their work, you don't like what they do, and you'll notice this again on some of the TV shows that are talent shows, they tend to tell you the positives of what they see about your performance. I like that you stood up there, and I like that you were brave. I like the way you came out. I like the way you dressed. And you know the shoe is going to fall. You know that you could actually hear that it's going to happen. But they give you enough so that when they let you down gently. Is there a way of talking to people to let them down gently? I remember a man I knew who once went up to a beautiful woman in the street. He tells a story about how he went up to this beautiful woman, and he was just surprised by how attractive she was to his eye. And he went over to her and he said, I'd really like to meet you. I find you so attractive. And she said to him, oh, she said, that's so sweet of you. You certainly are a handsome man. I am in a relationship with somebody where I am totally committed. I have no interest in forming a relationship with anyone else, but I'm sure some other person is going to be lucky to find you. And he was rejected and not rejected. He was okay. Well, maybe that's going a little too far, but maybe there's a way of telling people you don't want something. Did you ever have, you know, when you're a salesperson, some of the terrible things that I've seen with salespeople. I had a friend who used to make chocolates, and she would make chocolates, and she would just love to make chocolates. And then the chocolates were so good that people said, oh, you should package them. So she got a kick out of packaging these chocolates. She would package them and put them in beautiful packages, and she would spend more money on the packages than she would possibly get when selling them. And then she would bring them to a store or a restaurant, and the restaurant would buy these packaged chocolates from her. But she was a fairly elegant lady and was doing this kind of as a hobby. But I remember once I was in a store when she came in, and the owner of the store said, up, stand in the back there. I can't deal with any sellers right now. And treated her like she was dirt. Because anybody who is selling anything has to deal with the rejection of somebody who may be buying it. You're looking for their approval. They're buying something from you. And she practically wept. She had never been treated like that. Who tells her to stand in the corner? You know? It's like that scene from Dirty Dancing. What was that one? Everybody knows it. It's for sure. Nobody. Fill in the blanks. I'm sure it's there. This is Armand DeMille with you. So the way that you tell somebody no is important. Email? Text? Nowadays, there are so many different variations. In my eyes, maybe you have a better idea. How do you turn people down when they want something from you that you don't want to give them? What's your way of doing it? Maybe you could send me some response to that. Maybe as well to armand@thepositivemind.com. I would like to learn from you. Thank you. I'll be back with you soon. So in summary, what we're looking at is the feeling of rejection is, number one, an illusion. It is not a feeling itself. You are rejected. Somebody did not give you something you wanted. As a result of that, you have to look for a number of feelings that you could feel, and you would ask yourself the following questions. Do I feel sad, mad, glad, or bad? Aren't those four easy ones? Sad. Sad because I lost something I wanted. Mad because I don't like being told I can't have what I want. Glad because I'm relieved I didn't want it in the first place. Bad because I'm feeling a sinking deep feeling of depression. Now, if you feel bad, then that means that something in your expectations was out of whack. You were expecting something to fill some hole in your life right now. And that didn't happen. So the reframing of it in your mind is to ask yourself, do I feel sad, mad, glad, or do I feel bad? And if you get to that bad feeling, the one that feels like depression, think to yourself, I have done something. I was trying to fill a hole. I was looking to manipulate the world. I was looking to find something that would make me feel better about myself, and it didn't manifest. What do I need to feel better about myself? Well, you start with a conversation with yourself. Start with saying hello to that kid inside you who is feeling this deep, deep need. And instead of turning over to somebody else and saying, will you approve of me? Start with giving the approval to yourself. And if you start with that, then when you go to someone else and ask for something, if you go for a job interview, if you go somewhere, you bring with you a more total, better self, a stronger self. There's a kid on the inside of your chest who's knocking, waiting to have you take care of him. This is Armand Demuth with The Positive Mind. We'll be back.
Why are there so many songs about rainbows? And what's on the other side? Rainbows are visions, but only illusions. And rainbows have nothing to hide. So we've been told, and some choose to believe it. I know they're wrong, wait and see. Someday we'll find it, the rainbow connection, the lovers, the dreamers, and me.
You are listening to The Positive Mind with Armand Demuth on WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial.
Finding a path with the heart. Carlos Castaneda. Anything is one of a million paths. Therefore, you must always keep in mind that a path is only a path. And if you feel you should not follow it, you must not stay with it under any conditions. To have such clarity, you must lead a disciplined life. Only then will you know that any path is only a path, and there's no affront to oneself or to others in dropping it, if that's what your heart tells you to do. But your decision to keep on a path or to leave it must be free of fear or ambition. I warn you, look at every path closely and deliberately. Try it as many times as you think necessary, and then ask yourself and yourself alone one question. The question is one that only a very wise old man asks. My benefactor told me about it once when I was young, but my blood was too vigorous for me to understand it. Now I do understand it, and I'll tell you what it is. Does this path have a heart? You see, all paths are the same. They go nowhere. They're paths going through the bush or into the bush. In my own life, I could say I've traversed long, long paths, but I'm not anywhere. So my benefactor's question has meaning now. Does this path have a heart? If it does, the path is good. If it does not, it is of no use. Both paths lead nowhere, but one has a heart, the other does not. One makes for a joyful journey. As long as you follow it, you are one with it. The other will make you curse your life. One makes you strong, the other weakens you. The trouble is nobody asks the question, and when a man finally realizes that he or she has taken a path without a heart, the path is ready to kill them. At that point, very few people can stop to deliberate and leave the path. A path without a heart is never enjoyable. You have to work hard even to take it. On the other hand, a path with a heart is easy. It does not make you work at liking it. So when asking the question about love, if the love is painful, if the path is painful, it's not enjoyable. It doesn't have a heart. You see, for me, there is only the traveling on paths that have a heart, or on any path that may have a heart. There I travel, and the only worthwhile challenge is to traverse its full length. And there I travel, looking, looking breathlessly. This is Armand DeMille back with you with A Positive Mind here on WBAI 99.5 FM. So if we're talking about sensitivity to rejection, there are a lot of people who are involved in the arts and are curious about their own creativity. I meet many people who have lost their creativity completely. You know, there's something that happens to us when we're growing up. We sacrifice the mind that tends to be loose and free and develop the kind of mind that is more logical, more linear. Part of what is called maturity is to develop a problem-solving brain. That's what most early education is about. They teach us how to study the past, develop skills of repetition, and I understand that, but there's a cost to this conditioning. As adults, we're conditioned to believe that things always work a certain way, and we lose the unfettered imagination that we had as kids. We start off with the most amazingly creative, curious brains, and little by little we sacrifice it to become more logical and less creative. But most people, my friends, don't give it up completely, because creative thinking is essential to a successful, happy life. If you always know the end of every story, how can you see something that's a variation, the difference? Creativity is invaluable to problem solving, and it helps keep life fresh and exciting. But there's a lot of funny things that happen to our creativity, and that's what we're going to explore here today. We're going to take a closer look at creativity itself, because I think that it is the progressive loss of creativity that is our leading cause of premature aging, relationship degeneration, and in many ways, the most severe psychological problems. We lose our options. I think that a balance between creativity and logic is essential to a healthy mind. And if you have all logic and no creativity, life is dull and tends to be depressing. And if you have all creativity and no logic, life is chaotic and filled with desperation. Trying to find the rent for every month because you're being so creative and nobody appreciates you, but you can't afford to work. There's an important balance between creativity and logic that's essential to maintain. The logic seems to increase with age or by itself. As we get older, we have more experience of what works and what does not work, and we have a tendency towards repeating things that work and avoiding things that don't work. It makes sense, doesn't it? How about you, my friends? I mean, how about you? What about your creativity? Is it included in your life every day? Is it there at all? Do you examine packaging? Do you dance? Do you sing? So when we give up our creativity because we have to get things done, we lose opportunity for newness. Just look at some of the older people you know. They feel more frail, more breakable, so they tend to do things that they have done before and tend to turn down every opportunity to do things that they've never done before. That seems to be what's happened to Florida. The retirement community is filled with the same condos, the same restaurants, the same design, the same behaviors. No children allowed to be running near the swimming pool. They may do something brand new, unexpected. They may disturb the predictable. So I say keeping creativity alive is essential, because if you don't have the creativity, you're just getting ready to die. Just preparing to sign off. Now, there's also such a thing as too much creativity, a problem facing many people in the arts. And that's another bit of the stuff we're going to have to look at today, because it affects you in every walk of life. Your creativity affects your work life, your love life, and the quality of every breath you take. To prove this point, look at the enormous sums of money spent on entertainment. Theater tickets, $300, $500 for a theater ticket. As we lose our personal creativity, we try to keep in touch with creative energy by buying someone else's. People who have a lot of creativity spend far less time and energy eating someone else's creative energy. Broadway theaters that are so filled with those expensive tickets, middle-aged people who have lost their ability to entertain themselves with their own creativity, go to get it from the outside. And when you're young, you keep it going. That's why dance is important in youth. It is an opportunity for creative expression. Have you stopped dancing? How about movies, movie lines, and swarms of people desperate to find something that'll wake up their tired minds? Humans need creativity. It represents growth and newness. Every cell in the human body is either growing or dying, and there's no such thing as staying the same. Freud used to think that there was a homeostasis that we were searching for. He was a neurologist, and he believed that the neurological system was searching for a state of homeostasis, and that meant it was trying to find a place where it could be peaceful. We later learned that that's not true. Every cell in the human body is always growing or dying. There is no homeostasis. There is no place where everything is in perfect balance. The pendulum is either swinging up or swinging down. There is no such thing as staying the same. So unconsciously, I believe we sense that sameness is death. So we're always searching out newness on some level. And we lose our ability to generate that newness. We depend on other people to do it for us. So many of us develop hobbies, maintaining our creativity. Many people in a desperate search for newness on the outside, because they lose the newness of creativity on the inside, live to travel. The airlines are booked solid with people trying to get away. Get away from what? Get away from the same. Going towards something different. And then, of course, there are all of those Xbox games. There are all those games that you could look at over and over again that seem creative, that you're playing and you're just going to the next level and the next level. What's happened? What's being built? I have a small, in our waiting room, we have a small little sandbox. It's like a Zen sandbox, a little rake. And every now and then I step out in the waiting room, and just as I'm leaving, I look at the amazing patterns that people have created. And I think while they're sitting waiting there, people have had the opportunity to create something. And I saw some things that were so beautiful that we had to take photographs of it. You have that. Unless you're one of those folks who always go to the same place and do the same thing every year, snowbirds, who just extend the boundaries of their sameness. Ready for this? Just to tweak your interest. Most extramarital affairs are started by people who feel their creativity dying. Yes, having an affair is a creative thought. Am I recommending it? No. You're going to get angry at me for saying this. Please don't. For many people, especially men, the only place they have left to be creative is the excitement of romancing someone they just met. The big deal is not the sex, but the creativity it takes to pull it off. You should pardon the expression. Want a big hint on how to keep your mate from going astray? Get them involved in something creative. Wake up that part of them that is caught in a rut. Buy them an instrument that they always wanted to play or used to play as a child. And with it, arrange home visit lessons by a teacher who will get them started or restarted. Play with them. Get an instrument yourself. Creativity, variability, different things that are different. Try to introduce something new into the relationship. When the relationship gets old, people look for the creative on the outside. And then compliment them, encourage them, never be critical of their practice. It's a relationship saver. One woman I know took her husband to see a show called Stomp, which was down at the Orpheum Theater here in New York City, a remarkable program of rhythmic creativity. And after that, she got her guy a drum and drumming lessons. It turned his life around. Turned his neighbor's life around, too. But she claims it saved their marriage. He actually looked forward to being at home again. I believe that most midlife crisis is a result of lost creativity. So how do you keep our creative spirit alive? And what happens when your creativity gets blocked? And what are we going to be looking at in order to find this? You know me, I'm going to look at childhood roots to get the answers to most of these questions. Because creativity is a natural part of childhood, and somehow, to the child, someone is always discouraging our real creativity. I know a man, a very musically oriented businessman who plays piano. He plays near-perfect Gershwin. When he was a child, his mother forced him to study and learn piano. She didn't let him play with the other kids. She insisted he practice and practice. And he developed a great repertoire of songs he plays, but it's a funny thing. He has a grand piano at home he never touches, and the only time he plays is to entertain other people. Is that being creative when you're playing for people? Number one, if you're stuck in the muck of a routine life, break your routines. Go to work by a different route. Walk a different path. Take a bus instead of the subway. And don't be so time conscious doing it. In other words, allow an extra 15 minutes to get to work and don't take the shortest route. Number two, learn to look at problems from many angles. There's a game you can play called What If? And here's what you do. You get one die. That's half a pair of dice. One die. You take any situation. You find six possible courses of action for any one situation. So you, for example, you say, number one, I think I'll go to the store uptown. Number two, I think I won't go to the store. Number three, I think I'll make myself lunch. Number four, and you put down five options and you roll the die. And you follow, just for one day, you follow whatever the die says. There's a book called Dice Man that was based on this. It was phenomenal. And just you follow, you see where it takes you for one day. For one day, you just follow the die. For example, what to wear tomorrow. Find six outfits, each one significantly different than the other, but all within acceptable range. For those of you who think you don't have six options because you're really too poor to afford new clothes, I promise you, if you really think about it, you have six outfits. Now give each outfit a number from 1 to 6. Roll the die, and that's one piece of a pair of dice. Roll the die and do what chance selection is. Wear that outfit, whatever it is. Or think of Saturday. Six options for what you can do on Saturday. Roll the die, be sure you do it. One person I know did this every day at least once for a week. Look at situations, roll the die, there's one half a pair of dice, and follow through. This relates so much to the path with the heart, you'll be amazed how rich life could be when you're taking variations that you don't expect. Carry the die in your pocket somewhere. Fondle it regularly. Here's suggestion number three. Get an instrument. Is there an instrument that you always wanted to play? Did you always want to play guitar? Did you always want to sing? Do you have a relationship with your instrument? A lot of people who are singers, I have a good friend. She is she loves lyrics. And she remembers lyrics. I do too. Lyrics to songs. Whenever she sings, she mocks her own voice. She stretches her voice as if she's expecting you to laugh at her when she's singing. And yet she's got a lovely voice. She's got a fine voice. So when she's trying to recite lyrics to a song, as she and I will often do because we'll run into a song that we'll both know the lyrics to, she's always kind of mocking herself, stretching her voice. And I ask her, I say, why don't you just sing it normally with me? And we do. But the idea is that if you have a bad relationship with your instrument, which could be your voice, could be your dance, if you're comparing yourself to other people, then you have a bad relationship with your instrument. So you've got to get a little more friendly. A good example of that would be in the shower, singing in the shower. I know a woman who at the age of 45 got a cello and took lessons. She never plays for anybody but herself. She practices 3 times a week, and her cello is now part of her soul. It's never too late, my friends, never. Suggestion number four for rejuvenating your creativity. Try to think in opposites. For example, if you're trying to save money, spend some time thinking of the wildest ways you could spend it. Very often you'll spot a solution in the ridiculous. So if you're trying to meet a new mate, think of becoming a successful hermit living in a cave in the Himalayas. Stretch the thought. Think of how you would pack up everything, say goodbye to everyone, when you would take everything you would take to your cave. Think it through. Maybe even write it down. Make it ridiculous. The ridiculous is often the haven of creative solutions. I'll repeat that. The ridiculous is often the haven of creative solutions. Number five, there are many forms of creativity. You don't only have to be creative artistically. You can be creative sexually. You can be creative through cooking, food, anything, making a sandwich. You'd be amazed at how stodgy people get. You can be creative with your own sexuality in so many ways with yourself. So many people find the only way of pleasuring themselves is always the same. Try something different. Number six, become a protector of creativity itself. Make a private commitment never to squelch a creative thought in another person, especially if the thought is ridiculous. Now, this is difficult because if you have someone who's working with you and their job is to line up the ducks and you're the boss who wants to have just the ducks lined up just the way you want, and they come to you with a creative idea, it is really important that you help them with that creative idea, that in some way you help them follow that through as well as them lining up the ducks for you. Every squelch kills a tiny bit of the spirit on this planet. Creativity became a very important part of my life. I was introduced to jazz clubs by a wonderful neighbor. There was a man who lived next door. His name was Dick Ward. And so when I would be leaving my house as a kid, running around the streets like every other kid did, Dick kind of took me under his wing. You'll know him. He's a famous actor. He was in a couple of movies. And Richard took me under his wing, and he would bring me to a club called the Five Spot Cafe. The Five Spot Cafe, at the time, even though I was a young guy, they let me in. I didn't drink. They didn't mind. And I would see jazz musicians getting up on stage, one after another, and I saw all of the greats. I grew up watching everybody. Thelonious Monk was there the most, but everybody was there, everybody you could imagine. All of the great musicians. And you would hear them playing, and what jazz itself was, it was the essence of creativity, because in jazz you don't follow a line. You have a line in your mind, but everything is about variation. Variation on a theme. If you listen to Charlie Parker, when he would play tenor saxophone, he didn't play notes, he played between notes. And then when you would hear the great singers, they would play between the notes, not the notes themselves, and variations. We did some wonderful recordings here with people who are great jazz musicians. And the music lends itself. Now, through that, of course, I was introduced to classical music as well, which is another amazing form of creativity. How could you not listen to Mozart and think of creativity? How did he ever put that together? So music to me is essential, and that's why you hear during every radio program that we do, I will bring you music that I think brings in some creative element to what we're talking about. And the reason I introduce the music is like it's a, well, let's talk about learning. If you learn something and you learn one thing after another, you can have a thing called proactive inhibition. Proactive inhibition is when something that follows something else that's similar, if you hear my voice, and then you hear me say something else that's similar to it, you can forget the first thing I told you. And another thing called retroactive inhibition, which is the second thing I teach you, makes you forget the second thing, but then you remember only the first thing. The way that you get around these inhibitions of memory is you do something different instead. So if you're learning math, for example, and you're a guy studying in school, and if you're learning math, the next thing to learn is go study biology, but don't do more math. See, then go study your language. Change it. Don't try to stay in the same place, because if you study philosophy and then psychology and then medicine, you're going to get crazy because they all run into each other. That's the proactive inhibition. And the retroactive inhibition. So therefore, I like having music. I throw music in because I want you to somehow let whatever we were talking about settle into your mind. And from the appreciation I get from you, it seems to be people like it. And some people don't. Some people would rather I just kept on talking. I'm going to now read you a poem written by a 16-year-old boy in high school. He always wanted to explain things, but no one cared. So he drew. Sometimes he would draw and it wasn't anything. He wanted to carve it in stone or write it in the sky, and it would be only the sky and him and the things inside him that needed saying, and it was after that that he drew the picture. He kept it under his pillow and would let no one see it. And he would look at it every night and think about it. And then it was dark and his eyes were closed. He could still see the picture. And it was all of him, and he loved it. When he started school, he brought the picture with him, not to show anyone, but just to have it with him like a friend. It was funny about school. He sat in a square brown desk like all the other square brown desks. He thought it should be red. And his room was a square brown room like all the other rooms. It was tight and close and stiff. He hated to hold the pencil and the chalk, with his arms stiff and his feet flat on the floor, stiff, with the teacher watching and watching. The teacher came and spoke to him. She told him to wear a tie like all the other boys. He said he didn't like them. And she said it didn't matter. After that, they drew. And he drew all yellow, and it was the way he felt about morning, and it was beautiful, and the teacher came and smiled at him and said, "What's this?" She asked, "Why don't you draw something like Ken's drawing? Isn't it beautiful?" After that, his mother bought him a tie. And he always drew airplanes and rocket ships like everybody else. And he threw the old picture away. And when he lay out alone looking at the sky, it was big and blue and all of everything, but he wasn't everything anymore. He was square inside and brown, and his hands were stiff, and he was like everyone else. And the things inside him that needed saying didn't need it anymore. It had stopped pushing. It was crushed. It was stiff. He was just like everyone else.
This voiceless cry of mercy.
It was written by a 16-year-old boy. This is Armand DeMille with you. Keep the spirit alive, my friends. Keep the spirit alive. If you want to get a copy of today's program, you can go to the website, thepositivemind.com. You can hear it again. You can go to WBAI.org. It's also an excellent time for you to remember that programs like this are brought to you through the good graces of Pacifica and WBAI, and we can always use your support and help. If you are not a buddy of the Positive Mind, please consider, go to WBAI.org, find the Buddy button, and become a member. Become someone who supports us. We need all the help we can get. Be back with you soon, my friends.
Thank you.